I was thinking earlier about a bloke I heard of who'd been inviting his friends to come to church for ages and ages, and eventually the friend agreed to come along. And on that particular Sunday morning, the pastor started a 12-week series on all the places in the Bible where God kills people. And the reason I thought about that is there's misprint in the notice sheet this morning, where instead of Meet the Real Jesus Part 4, When Tragedy Strikes, it's listed as being When Tragedy Strikes Part 4. So I imagined how well that series would go down. Can I have the slides, please? Thanks. So here's the thing. It's a crucial part of our lives, isn't it? We obviously, and for good reason, like to think much more about all the great things about life and all the great things about Christianity and the goodness of God and the gifts that he gives. And yet, when you read the one book in the Bible that's essentially a songbook, the book of all the worship songs that the Israelites used to sing, the book of Psalms. There's 150 of them. Half of them are about how hard things are. So there are psalms in there that are just straightforward worship, sure. And they're the ones that tend to get rewritten into Hillsong's tunes. But there are loads of others that are complaining about the situation people find themselves in and their enemies are around them and how they're sick or they feel abandoned by God and all sorts of things. And it's we're probably not doing ourselves any favours if we think about Christianity in a way that's all sunshine and lollipops and rainbows, and overlook the very real truth that actually life isn't always like that, and sometimes terrible things happen. And I want to be quite serious about it for a minute, so I want to ground this in some real examples. Years ago, when Fiona and I used to be in a church in Bermondsey, central London, there was I think of them as an older couple, but I guess they were about as old as we are now. And they were called Ruth and Eric used to cycle to work. And one day, completely out of the blue, he was hit by a lorry and killed. And no one saw it coming. You know, it wasn't one of those things where you have a chance to prepare in advance and you know that a bad thing's coming. It's just one day he was there, the next day he was gone. Closer to home, I think probably most people here know Fiona had cancer a few years ago. And thank God she's as healthy as a badger now. But at the time, you know, she went through all the chemotherapy and all the rest of it. It was awful, terrible time. And going back a bit further, people who've been in this church for a while will remember Luella, who was with us, Filipino family, when we were not long after we'd moved into the church hall. And she had cancer and didn't get better. And she died and she left behind young children. And they moved back to the Philippines. Terrible things happen. So how do we respond to things like this? Well, there are at least three different responses that people can have. There are probably more, but the three I want to touch on today. One of them is wanting an explanation, wanting God to explain, looking for answers, looking for understanding. And some people, it's just in their nature that this is how they tend to respond to things. I would probably go that way most of the while. Other people, most naturally, just have an emotional reaction. And maybe that's more common. just to be sad, to mourn, to weep when something bad happens. Or a third possible response is just to shut down completely. You sometimes see, don't you? People go into depression, which is not extreme sadness. Depression is, it's really the absence of emotion, when the emotions shut down. And when you find that you do nothing at all. And all of these are ways that, in one way I could say different people have a tendency to react in different ways. It's also true that all of us at different times will react in all of these ways. So you might be thinking, well, what's the right way to respond? And which is the way that God wants us to respond? And then we think, well, how does God react to us when we respond in all these different ways? And these are very practical, down-to-earth kinds of issues that we will all have to deal with at some time. Some of us, probably, are dealing with something like this right now. You know, ill health in the family, or someone you know has died, or difficulties at work, or whatever it might be. But those of us who are not facing something like that, it's a solid bet that we will at some stage. So to find our way through this, I want to look at this story of Lazarus, which Nikki read out to us. I'm going to read it again so to help it really settle in to our minds. And we'll see how different people reacted and how Jesus responded to them. So I'm going to read the whole story again. We're in John 11. This is from the New Living Translation. A man named Lazarus was sick. He lived in Bethany with his sisters Mary and Martha. And this is the Mary who later poured the expensive perfume on the Lord's feet and wiped them with her hair. Her brother Lazarus was sick. So the two sisters sent a message to Jesus telling him, "Lord, your dear friend is very sick." But when Jesus heard about it, he said, "Lazarus' sickness will not end in death. No, it happened for the glory of God, so that the Son of God will receive glory from this." So although Jesus loved Martha, Mary, and Lazarus, he stayed where he was for the next 2 days. And finally, he said to his disciples, "Let's go back to Judea. Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but now I will go and wake him up." And the disciples said, "Lord, if he's sleeping, he'll soon get better." They thought Jesus meant Lazarus was simply sleeping, but Jesus meant that Lazarus had died. So he told them plainly, "Lazarus is dead, and for your sakes, I'm glad I wasn't there, for now you will really believe. Come, let's go see him." When Jesus arrived at Bethany, he was told that Lazarus had already been in his grave for 4 days. Well, Bethany was only a few miles down the road from Jerusalem, so many of the people had come to console Martha and Mary in their loss. When Martha got word that Jesus was coming, she went to meet him. But Mary stayed in the house. And Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if only you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that God will give you whatever you ask." Jesus told her, "Your brother will rise again." "Yes," Martha said, "he will rise when everyone else rises at the last day." And Jesus told her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Anyone who believes in me will live even after dying. Everyone who lives in me and believes in me will never ever die." "And do you believe this, Martha?" "Yes, Lord," she told him. "I've always believed you were the Messiah, the Son of God, the one who has come into the world from God." But then she returned to Mary. She called Mary aside from the mourners and told her, "The teacher is here and wants to see you." So Mary went immediately to him. Jesus had stayed outside the village at the place where Martha met him. When the people who were at the house consoling Mary saw her leave so hastily, they assumed she was going to Lazarus' grave to weep, so they followed her there. When Mary arrived and saw Jesus, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if only you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping and saw the other people wailing with her, a deep anger welled up within him and he was deeply troubled. "Where have you put him?" he asked them. They told him, "Lord, come and see." And then Jesus wept. And the people who were standing nearby said, "See how much he loved him." But some said, "This man healed a blind man. Couldn't he have kept Lazarus from dying?" Jesus was still angry as he arrived at the tomb, a cave with a stone rolled across its entrance. "Roll the stone aside," Jesus told them. But Martha, the dead man's sister, protested, "Lord, he's been dead for 4 days. The smell will be terrible." Jesus responded, "Didn't I tell you that you would see God's glory if you believe?" So they rolled the stone aside. And then Jesus looked up to heaven and said, "Father, thank you for hearing me. You always hear me, but I've said it out loud for the sake of all these people standing here, so that you will believe, they will believe you sent me." And then Jesus shouted, "Lazarus, come out." And the dead man came out, his hands and feet bound in grave clothes, his face wrapped in a headcloth. And Jesus told them, "Unwrap him and let him go." And many of the people who were with Mary believed in Jesus when they saw this happen. So I want to look first at Martha. And as I read this, what I find is that she is one of these people who wants to understand, who wants to get some grip on what's happened and figure out what it's about. She says, Lord, if only you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that God will give you whatever you ask. So she's looking for answers here. And then she goes on to propose an answer. He will rise when everyone else rises at the last day. Now, Martha's looking for Jesus to give her some understanding about what's gone on. And what does he say? I am the resurrection and the life. Anyone who believes in me will live, even after dying. Now, Martha's groping towards some kind of understanding of what can happen with Lazarus. She's very perceptive, by the way. Do you remember, if you remember a few weeks ago when I was talking about the resurrection, I made the point that all through the Old Testament, the Jews didn't really have a notion of life after death. So Martha would have been quite unusual at that time in having recognized that there is a resurrection to come. But she has this, what understanding she has, obviously doesn't see it as clearly as she wants to. And Jesus gives her an incredible explanation, actually, an amazing insight. And it's one of the, you know, one of the great statements in the Bible, isn't it? When he says, I am the resurrection and the life. Anyone who believes in me will live even after dying. And it's interesting to think about when that gets said. He didn't proclaim it to a synagogue full of high-powered Jews, or he didn't bring it to an academic conference as an important thing to be contemplated. He brought it to a woman that nobody had ever heard of in a little village that wasn't even in Jerusalem. It was outside it, in the moment of her need, when she needed something to understand and to cling on to. That's when this incredible new insight came. Jesus saying, I am the resurrection and the life. And of course, what followed from this, and Martha at that point didn't really understand this, but what followed from it is that because Jesus, who is the resurrection, who is the life, was right there at that time, in that place, where the body of Lazarus was. So that meant for Lazarus, that resurrection could come today. Which, of course, is what Martha needed to understand. And by the way, this again echoes back to something I preached here ages and ages ago. Third time I ever preached here, actually, was on I am the resurrection. And this crucial point here is Jesus is not saying, I have the power to bring resurrection. Or I've got a direct line to God the Father and I can pray effectively and God will raise Lazarus from the dead. What Jesus says is a much more powerful thing than this. I am the resurrection. So there's no question at all. If people ever say, oh, Jesus never claimed to be God, it's an ideal sometimes here. It is a complete nonsense to say that, because all the while, all the way through the Gospels, you see this kind of thing all the while. Jesus making statements that make no sense at all for anybody but God himself to make. So he's saying, I am the resurrection. Even the phrasing of that kind of declarative, I am, I think is an echo back to what Fiona was talking about earlier, the very name that God gives himself. Way back in the book of Exodus, when Moses says, who shall I say sent me? And God's answer is, I am. And in six other places in John's Gospel, Jesus says similar things. He says, I'm the door, I am the good shepherd, I am the bread of life, I'm the light of the world. Over and over again, these I am statements. So, in speaking to Martha, we'll just mention this in passing, Jesus was emphasizing that he was God. But then a little later, Mary comes to speak to Jesus as well. And although she starts with the exact same words, her position is very different. So she, like Martha, says, Lord, if only you had been here, my brother would not have died. But Martha's fallen at Jesus' feet. She's weeping. She's a mess. She's not there looking for any answers. She's not asking him to explain anything. In fact, she doesn't say anything else at all after this. She just says those words and then starts crying. So, I mean, the first thing here is I don't for a moment want to say that Martha's response is better than Mary's or that Mary's is better than Martha's. These are both perfectly reasonable ways to react in tragic situations. But what I want to draw attention to is that Jesus' response to each of the sisters is the response that they need. He doesn't have a single response that he just brings to everybody. So what in fact happened is that Jesus wept with Mary. Doesn't explain anything to her. He just sits there with her and cries when Jesus saw her weeping. and saw the other people wailing with her. A deep anger welled up within him, and he was deeply troubled. "Where have you put him?" he asked them. They told him, "Lord, come and see." And then the shortest verse in the Bible, in most translations, it's just two words. Jesus wept. Now, by the way, I grew up with a New International Version of the Bible, and that passage that we just read there, it says that Jesus was deeply moved. So I was really surprised when I came to study this passage again for this sermon. We mostly use the New Living Translation in this church, so I tend to preach from that just so anyone who's following along has the right version. And in there it says not Jesus was deeply moved, it says he was angry. And I thought, well, funny New Living Translation, what's that doing there? And I looked into it a little more, and it turns out that is actually a much more accurate translation. And almost everybody who's looked into this says that this is what the words mean. And it's almost as though the people who translated the New International Version were a little bit cowardly and didn't quite want to say that. So what's going on here? Why is Jesus angry? Well, you don't often see Jesus angry in the New Testament. It does happen. It doesn't happen often. And I think what's happening here is that he is angry, not with any of the people who are there. You certainly don't see any indication in what he says that he's angry with Mary or with Martha or with the mourners or anything like that. He's angry with death itself. This idea that something comes along and takes away from us the life that God has given is kind of an abomination. It feels wrong on a deep level. Now, I don't know whether everybody else feels this in the same sort of way I do, but it feels to me like a violation. And even sort of in a way where when you think about physics, you know, energy can't be created or destroyed, but only transformed from one form to another. And you have all these conservation laws in physics that say once something that exists continues to exist. And yet when we look at human death, it feels as though a life is just wiped out and all the knowledge that person had is just gone and it's destroyed. And do you understand what I say when I say it sort of feels like a violation of something, almost like a violation of the laws of nature? And that, I think, is why Jesus was angry. I think he felt that same thing far more clearly and deeply than we can feel it. So he, at that stage, is very angry at the idea of death. But his response with Mary is not anger, but just straightforward sadness. When Jesus saw her weeping and saw the other people wailing with her, a deep anger welled up within him. But then just two verses later, it's Jesus wept. So what's going on? Is he angry or is he sad? Well, anybody who has ever been human will know that emotions can get kind of complicated. And there's the best illustration I know of that. Anybody who's not seen this film, Inside Out, I cannot recommend it highly enough as a glimpse for sort of brain-oriented people like me, a glimpse of what it's like for normal people living in ordinary minds with all these emotions running around all over the place and interacting with each other and colliding. It's complicated. All this stuff gets very complicated. So one of the kind of little fringe things you can take away from this is just not to be surprised or upset or disappointed in that. If your own feelings, when something terrible happens, if your feelings are complicated or contradictory, that's okay. This is the nature of being human. So in the way that Mary approached Jesus, what she saw in him at that time was that he was a person, he was a man, he was human. So Mary and Martha, with their very different responses to tragedy, actually saw very different aspects of the whole nature of Jesus there. They saw he was God, they saw that he was man. So those are two of the reactions. Do you remember we started with some people's response to tragedy is looking to understand. Some people just need sympathy. And the third one is somebody who simply can't respond at all. And in this case, that person is Lazarus. And the reason he didn't respond is for the rather obvious reason that he was completely dead. When Jesus arrived at Bethany, he was told that Lazarus had already been in his grave for 4 days. So, Jesus' response to Martha was explanation. His response to Mary was comfort. His response to Lazarus is life. The response to death is life. Just read these verses again. Jesus shouted, "Lazarus, come out." And the dead man came out, his hands and feet bound in grave clothes, his face wrapped in a headcloth. And Jesus told them, "Unwrap him and let him go." Now, what a spectacular thing to do. It's in a different kind of league, you might almost say, from his responses to Martha and to Mary. And Martha just needed some explanation. Mary just needed some sympathy. Lazarus, I don't know whether you picked this up earlier in the story, Lazarus was dead. What that means is he wasn't alive. Sympathy wasn't going to help him. Explanations weren't going to help him. The only thing that would help him is life. And life is what Jesus brings there. And you may say, well, how does that apply to us? Because we're everybody who's here in this building got here by being alive and walking in or getting in a car or something. And of course, it's true that physically we're alive. Our bodies are alive. They're functioning to a greater or lesser degree. Our bodies work and we're alive. But of course, what the Bible talks about is also a spiritual death. And I want to show you this verse from Ephesians. This is one of Paul's letters. He says, God is so rich in mercy and he loved us so much that even though we were dead because of our sins, he gave us life when he raised Christ from the dead. Now, Paul is not a fluffy writer. He's not the kind of person to just kind of vaguely say something that's more or less what he means. Most of his writing is very precise, and he's always, you know, going off on little sub-clauses to explain in detail what he means by something. So when Paul uses the word dead here, he's not messing about. What he is saying is that in his understanding, before people knew Jesus, before they came to him, what they had was only one kind of life, a physical life, but not a spiritual life. And of course, what he's saying here is that was true of us. Maybe some of us, maybe that's still true. Maybe, yeah, I know a lot of you here, I know most of you are Christians. If you're here today and you're not a Christian, if you have never made that step of handing your life over to Jesus and trusting him, then the Bible's description of you is that spiritually you are dead. Now, I don't know whether you feel dead, if you're even out there. I don't even know if I'm talking to anyone here, but if you are, maybe you feel that, maybe you sense that in the way your life is going, in the way things are failing to satisfy you, if things can't be wrestled around to how you want them to be, if things that used to bring you joy don't, then what you're feeling there is what the Bible describes as spiritual deadness. And the prescription for someone who's dead is life. So I recommend life. Now, I'd like to move on a little from that now and look at this problem of why we suffer at all in the first place. So we've got the story of Lazarus. One of the questions you would ask about this is, well, why did Jesus allow Lazarus to die at all? Why not just keep him alive in the first place? Why not have given him a kind of boost to healing last time he was in the area so that the sickness would never have affected him in the first place? Well, here's what Jesus says to his disciples. Lazarus is dead, and for your sakes, I'm glad I wasn't there, for now you will really believe. So in the case of Lazarus, what was going on here is that there was a miracle planned, if you like. And of course, this is how it worked out. So at the very end of the passage we're reading here, the last verse says that many of the people who were with Mary believed in Jesus when they saw this happen. You can understand it, can't you? It's not a bad little demonstration of power to raise someone from the dead. So what happened in this case is, as Jesus explains earlier in the passage, it happened for the glory of God, so that the Son of God will receive glory from this. And that's not isolated. We see this kind of thing a couple of times in the Bible. Two chapters earlier, Jesus heals a man who was born blind. And before this happens, his disciples come to Jesus and ask about the man and say, Rabbi, teacher, his disciples asked him, why was this man born blind? Was it because of his own sins or his parents' sin? Notice, by the way, they only offer those two options there. Those are the only things in their mental vocabulary at that stage. They just assume anything that's bad is a result of sin. Why do they assume that? It's because they've not read the book of Job. Anyway, Jesus answers and says, it was not because of his sins or his parents' sins. Jesus answered, this happened so the power of God could be seen in him. So in this particular case, this particular man, Jesus is telling us the reason he was born blind was so that Jesus would have the opportunity of healing him and of causing everything that came about as a result of that. So what we see here is that a bad thing is allowed to happen with the man born blind and in the case of Lazarus dying. And the reason is so that some better thing can happen down the line to the glory of God. Now, at one point, that was going to be sort of the conclusion of this sermon, or at least the central point, the main thing we're building up to. But I felt very uncomfortable about it, and I hope you do as well. And I hope you're sort of looking at that and thinking, well, you know, you've wrapped it all up in a little parcel with a bow on top, and it's very neat, but it doesn't ring true. It doesn't feel right. Because what about all the times when that doesn't happen? So it's all very well saying, oh, Lazarus died so that Jesus could raise him back to life, and that would be a greater miracle. But what about the people who die and then they don't get raised from the dead? So, you know, we really don't want to fall into the trap in the way we talk in the church of just spiritualizing everything to the point where it just becomes unreal to us. You know, I don't think we can really come away from this study in John 11 just saying, well, it's okay when bad things happen because God will do a greater miracle. So where does that leave us? Well, I want to go back to Martha, who gets very bad press. Martha, you remember that in the most famous story about her, Jesus comes to visit the house and she's rushing around getting all the food ready while Mary's just sitting at his feet learning from him. And everybody talks as though Martha's being a real idiot there. But I bet Jesus was glad that she prepared the food. My point is this. It's true that Mary is praised, and rightly, for her focus there, having been on the immediate presence of Jesus rather than on all the other bits and pieces that would need eventually to be done. But it isn't as though Martha was just off, I don't know, watching a football match or something. Rather, you know, she was there with Jesus. She was doing what she could to try and bring something good to him. And in this situation as well, we find that Martha actually does rather better than she's often given credit for. So let's look back at what she says here. You remember from much earlier, Lord, if only you had been here, my brother would not have died. And that's what Mary said as well, but she stopped there. And Martha is the one who goes on to say this, but even now, I know that God will give you whatever you ask. So of the two sisters in this situation, she's the one who has the faith. And she goes on with this really good insight. He will rise when everyone else rises at the last day. Now, you'll remember that Jesus' response to this is to say, I am the resurrection and the life. But he's not contradicting her there, is he? He's not correcting her. He isn't saying, no, Martha, you've misunderstood. Oh, I'm not talking about the resurrection at the last day. I'm talking about something different that I'm doing now. That's not how Jesus speaks at all. He's not correcting her. He's not shutting her down. He's expanding her understanding. He's giving her a better understanding of what she'd already got a glimpse of. So when he says, I am the resurrection and the life, he's explaining why it is that everyone else will rise at the last day. And then, of course, as we saw, that same great power that will apply to every one of us eventually is focused right down in the there and then, in that moment, to raise Lazarus then rather than the last day. But Martha's had a great insight here. Lazarus will rise when everyone else rises at the last day. And by the way, Lazarus better hope that's true, because, you know, when he was raised back to life in the first century, he presumably got another 50 or 60 years and then died again. And do you know, when he dies for the second time, it's not so immediately and obviously tragic as when a young man dies, but actually it's the same thing. It's the same abomination. It's the same violation that we talked about. All of those experiences and understanding that Lazarus had accumulated across his 70 years, or however long he lived, all his understanding of Jesus, all his unique insights into the character of Jesus that he had gathered from the time he spent on earth with Jesus, did all of that just vanish? Was that all gone? Was it just destroyed from the universe? Well, no. And Martha is the one who understands why, because she rightly says that Lazarus will rise when everyone rises at the last day. Good for Martha. So here is the better thing that will happen. You know, we were talking about sometimes God lets a bad thing happen so that a better thing can happen. And we gave the example of the man born blind. That's bad, but it was so that the better thing could happen, that was him getting healed. We're assured repeatedly through the New Testament that there is a better thing that will happen for every one of us, whatever our circumstances, whatever we're mourning. Here's what Paul writes in the first letter to the Corinthians. If our hope in Christ is only for this life, we are more to be pitied than anyone in the world. But in fact, Christ has been raised from the dead, and he is the first of a great harvest of all who have died. Now, again, Paul is a clear thinker. He is the man who says exactly what he thinks. And sometimes Christians, we can talk in a slightly fluffy way and say things like, oh, well, you know, even if I'm mistaken about Christianity, I'd still rather live this way. Paul doesn't say that. He says if our hope in Christ is only for this life, we are more to be pitied than anyone in the world. Why? Because Paul cares about what's true. Do you remember in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Slaty Bartfast says, I'd much rather be happy than right any day. And Arthur says, oh, and are you? And he says, no, that's where it all falls down. Well, you know, I almost feel like Paul hadn't read that, but there's something of the same spirit of that in this, because actually the reality is if you're fundamentally wrong about the universe, then there's a limit to how much comfort you can get from that. And Paul isn't interested in that kind of false comfort anyway. You know, he doesn't care about thinking my life now will be more pleasant if I have some kind of faith for the future. No, he says if our hope in Christ is only for this life, we are more to be pitied than anyone in the world. But, in fact, Christ has been raised from the dead, and he is the first of a great harvest of all who have died. Now, John 11 tells us about Lazarus being raised to life, but actually it's also the story of Martha, who will be raised to life, and of Mary, who will be raised to life, and of Lazarus, who will be raised to life again. It's a much bigger story than it appears to be. It's bigger on the inside. Paul, in the second letter to the Corinthians, writes this. When this earthly tent that we live in is taken down, that is, when we die and leave this earthly body, we will have a house in heaven, an eternal body made for us by God himself and not by human hands. So, what's the eternal body? I don't know. Paul writes elsewhere about the spiritual body, which almost seems like a contradiction in terms, doesn't it? We think about a human being made up of body, soul, and spirit, and the body and the spirit are two different things. So then what's a spiritual body? We don't know. That's okay, though. We don't need to understand this at this point. We just need to know that it's the promise, and that the life that God has for us after we are raised at the last day with everybody, including Lazarus, the life that he's got lined up for us is as much better as a house is than a tent. Now, someone like Michelle, who likes living in tents, you'll just have to take this analogy as Paul intended it. So for Paul, who was a tent maker by profession, for him, it wasn't a matter of you live in your nice house 51 weeks a year and then you go off and have a fun week having a camping adventure. For him, a tent was where you live day in, day out as you travel around. You're never warm, you're never comfortable, you can't cook properly. So like this poor guy here with his wretched tent in the woodlands, he's tried to rig up a chimney. And so what Paul's saying is that if you take a life like that and living in that kind of situation, compare that with stepping into a proper house with indoor plumbing and wireless internet access, then that's the kind of transformation that we're talking about in going from this life that we live now in the body that Paul describes as a tent, into the life that God has lined up for every one of us Lazarus included, Martha included, Mary included, me included, you included. From the same letter as the one we quoted before, Paul explaining in a little bit more detail here. Our earthly bodies are planted in the ground when we die, but they will be raised to live forever. Our bodies are buried in brokenness, but they will be raised in glory. They're buried in weakness, but they will be raised in strength. And again, this comes up over and over in Paul's writing, that the resurrection to come is not just bringing us back to how we were. It's not just more of the kind of life that we're used to. You know, we don't reach a great age like this guy, and then we go in the ground, and then later Jesus comes and picks him back out, and he looks like this again. No, something much, much better than that. Our bodies are buried in brokenness, but they're raised not just in health. They don't just get unbroken. They don't just get repaired. The body is raised in glory. That's the promise there. Now, what I want to land on, and we're approaching the end here, in a sense, is that the key verse to the whole of this passage, and it's this one. Roll the stone aside, Jesus told them, but Martha, the dead man's sister, protested, Lord, he has been dead for 4 days. The smell will be terrible. And if you take away nothing else from this sermon, take away, Lord, he has been dead for 4 days. The smell will be terrible. Here's why this is so important. It's because just a few verses earlier, probably just a couple of hours earlier in real time, remember Martha had been the one who said this. Jesus told her, everyone who lives in me and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this, Martha? Yes, Lord, she told him. I have always believed you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one who has come into the world from God. So she is the one who not only knows and loves Jesus, but believes he is who he says he is. She believes in the resurrection from the dead. She believes that he has the power to raise Lazarus. She believes, do you remember when she says, he wouldn't have died if you'd been here, but I know that even now God will do whatever you ask. She's saying, when she says that, a couple of hours before this, she's saying, I know that you can raise Lazarus from the dead here and now. Fast forward 2 hours, she's saying, Lord, he's been dead for 4 days, the smell will be terrible. What's happened here? Well, you can know a thing is true, but not feel it to be true. And I think that's what's going on here. So when Martha had come out earlier, she'd met Jesus, she was physically distant from the tomb, the sort of immediate feelings of it were not quite so strong in her heart at that time. And it was easier then for her to just think clearly and think, what do I know about Jesus? What do I know about God? What do I believe? What have I been convinced about? And in that mood, she was able to make these fantastic declarations. And yet then, as she came in closer to the tomb, to the place where presumably 4 days earlier, she'd been in that awful situation of just being there and mourning as her brother's body was put in there, stone rolled into the way. Do you know, it just crushes the emotions. And I think it's as simple as this, that we can know a thing is true, but when circumstances are bad, when we feel bad, when we just feel emotionally awkward, it's very hard to keep feeling that the things we know are true are true. And the trick, of course, is to keep knowing them. This is a quote that comes up again and again, especially in my preaching, which is C.S. Lewis's definition of faith. And the reason I love this is because it just nails down exactly what Martha needed then. He said, faith is holding on to things that your reason has once accepted in spite of your changing moods. Now, he in this book uses kind of mundane examples and talking about things like if you eat a bad meal and you get indigestion, then you just start feeling rotten, then you can't, you know, it changes the way you think about things that you know. But of course, it goes double for something as serious as when your brother has died. So what Martha needed to do was hold on to the things that her reason had once accepted in spite of her changing moods. She returns to the tomb. She feels the horror of it. She feels the death. She feels the sense, again, of what it was like to entomb her brother. But actually, you know, I don't want to say this as though I'm being critical of Martha, because she comes out really well in this story. But she could have got that last mark in the exam, if you like, if she had been able at that moment to have the faith to hold on to things that her reason had once accepted, rather than just giving in to the sort of fear of, oh, but what if his body's decomposed after all? So the thing to take away from that, I think, is partly just be kind to yourself. You can go easy on yourself. If at times you find that your feeling of faith is wavering, you find yourself in situations where you think, I've signed up to this. I believe in the goodness of God. But at the moment, I don't feel that God is good. I think one thing is you can just shrug and say, meh, that's just my emotions. I still know what's true. I want to finish with this observation that none of that means we don't feel the pain. Martha, even at her moments of greatest faith, of clearest understanding, would still have felt the pain of having watched her brother die, watched him being buried. And I would hate us to come away from this thinking that because we're Christians, we believe in the resurrection from the dead, and we continue to believe in our minds what we've once been persuaded of, even when we don't feel it to be true. I wouldn't want us to think that because of that, that means we must never be sad about anything. Because sad things are sad. Painful things are painful. You know, and in the case of when someone we love dies now, even if we're absolutely convinced in our hearts and minds, even if we feel in our emotions as well, that God will raise them to a new and greater and better life, that still means we're separated from them now, and that's still sad. So please, nobody feel that we shouldn't mourn when sad things happen. And yet, coming out the back of that, it's still true that God is good. He knows what we need. What we need is different for different people, and it's different for us at different times. Martha needed understanding. She needed to grasp what was going on. Jesus gave it to her and gave her a unique insight that nobody else in the world had heard up to that point. I'm the resurrection and the life. Mary just needed sympathy. She just needed Jesus to be there for her. And that's what he did. And Lazarus, of course, needed more than either of them. He needed life, and Jesus gave him life. When Jesus raised Lazarus, one of the things that was a sign pointing forward to his own resurrection, which was not far in the future at this point. This is coming towards the end of Jesus' time on earth. Because one of the things that happened when he raised Lazarus was, it says that's when the chief priests started plotting to kill Jesus, because they realized how much influence he was going to have. And in fact, it even says they plotted to kill Lazarus, which I think shows how far they'd fallen that they would do that. But I don't know if you noticed this detail when we read through the story earlier. When Jesus arrives at Lazarus' tomb, it says it was a cave with a stone rolled across its entrance. Roll the stone aside, Jesus told them. Well, that's exactly what happened, isn't it, a few months later. When Jesus was in the tomb, it was a cave with a stone rolled across its entrance, and that stone was rolled away, just as Lazarus's is. So in one sense, raising Lazarus was a sign that pointed forward a few months to Jesus being raised. But in another and arguably even greater sense, it was a sign pointing even further forward to the resurrection of all who trust in Jesus. So that what was done once for Lazarus, that was a manifestation of the power of Jesus Christ, who by his own power was raised from the dead a few months afterwards. And that same great power, Paul says, is at work in us who believe. That same resurrection power is available to us. And very last slide then, I just want to read you this couple of verses from the same letter that Paul wrote again, First Letter to the Corinthians, chapter 15. He says, let me reveal to you a wonderful secret. We will not all die, but we will all be transformed. It will happen in a moment, in the blink of an eye, when the last trumpet's blown. For when the trumpet sounds, those who have died will be raised to live forever. And we who are living will also be transformed. For our dying bodies must be transformed into bodies that will never die. Our mortal bodies must be transformed into immortal bodies. So that's the promise that Jesus has for us. It's the same promise that he demonstrated in the case of Lazarus. And it's there for every one of us. And that, in the end, is profound comfort that's available to us in any situation. Even facing our own death, I guess, you know, that's going to come to all of us at some stage. The great comfort is the knowledge that the God who loves us is also the God who has the power to raise us. And because he has the love, he will use that power to bring us back in these great resurrection bodies, spiritual bodies, imperishable bodies, immortal bodies that are far beyond anything we know now. And I'd like to hand over to Fiona to do the last song. But it's a very, very gentle song of simply God invited to speak to us, to minister to us, to give us the comfort that we need in the hardest of times. And again, I don't know what most of you are going through at the moment. Some of you, at the moment, this might feel irrelevant. You know, for you, it might just be a day when the sun's shining and you're off on holiday, and that's great. Some people probably are going through tough times now. And this song is a prayer that God will speak comfort to us.